conservative friends of Israel are embedded within the parties. So they have these people going to their events, going on their trips, and obviously it's they're fronts for the Israeli embassy in London, and that's a big claim, and I can back it up. So, for example, Al Jazeera did a very important investigation during Jeremy Corbyn's leadership of Labour called The Lobby, which went undercover within the Israel lobby, and particularly Labour Friends of Israel. And they recorded a official within Labour Friends of Israel saying, we work very closely with the Israeli embassy in London. When bad things happen and Israel's getting attacked in the media, they send us things to say in the media. So it's a front group. They also recorded an official from the Israel lobby, from Labour Friends of Israel, offering or promising £1 million to the chair of Labour Friends of Israel. All of this stuff, not barely any of it got covered in the mainstream media, but that kind of control is very, very real. And is, I think it's an outrage. You know, I want, I don't want any lobby groups in the UK to be controlling our policy. On our foreign policy, whether it's Israel, whether it's Saudi Arabia, whether it's Bahrain, every country has a lobby, but the Israel one is particularly powerful. And in fact, there was a very good memoir written by a foreign minister called Alan Duncan, who was foreign minister from 2016 to 2019. And I think that's the best window into how the Israel lobby works in the UK. And he said when he was going to be appointed Middle East Minister by Boris Johnson and Theresa May. Boris Johnson was then Foreign Secretary and Theresa May was Prime Minister. There was a call made to Theresa May's office, the Prime Minister's office, from Conservative Friends of Israel, who said, you cannot appoint Alan Duncan Middle East Minister because he has a moderate view of the Israel-Palestine conflict. He supports a two-state solution. That was too much for them. Mm-hmm. And what happened? Theresa May, the Prime Minister, the democratically elected Prime Minister, the person we're told is the most powerful person in the UK, listened to Conservative Friends of Israel and refused to appoint him Middle East Minister. And that was only because this lobby group. So that's a taste of how much power they have. And then, of course, in those memoirs, Alan Duncan, who's a conservative, he's not a someone I agree with politically, but he said he was talking to the permanent undersecretary of the UK Foreign Office, and he said to them, he said to him, he said, the Israelis think they control the Foreign Office, and they do. That's a line. Again, that line wasn't covered in the mainstream media, but that kind of control of our foreign policy is wrong and immoral. And it has been for a long time, but it's particularly wrong and immoral when you're talking about that foreign country that is having that has that much power over our political system committing a genocide that's been found by the UN just this week. So I hope that when light is shone on it and people hear about it, there's enough outrage that we can shut it down, because sure, it's an embarrassment.
Well, indeed, there's so many cases that we can mention. One of them that stands out right now, which is pretty recent, and I'm sure you've talked about this, but I'd like to hear from you in this program, and that is the case that involves Palestine Action that was banned as a and branded as a terrorist group. Now, what's interesting here, unfortunately, is the fact that when we talk about the Israeli lobby, my question to you is how and if it's the case where the influence of the Israeli lobby is so wide that it actually can affect laws, because we know that this has led to things like state persecution of journalists, for example, if I'm correct to say that. I mean, you have parts of Starmer's regime that is using anti-terror laws, misusing them, I should say, if you agree with that, in order to basically to shut down journalists. And that's happened in some cases that you have even mentioned yourself, like Aswan Stanley, who works for Electronic Intifada, coming into his home, raiding it, and they took all his computers, etc. So is the Israeli lobby in one form or another somewhat directing this for the Starmer government to act in such a way to misuse the law?
Well, I think that since the Labour government have come in, particularly in July 2024, we've seen unprecedented attacks on our civil rights and rights as journalists. One case which you mentioned is Asa Winstanley, who's covered the Israel lobby in this country more than any other journalist. And he had his house raided by police his electronic devices taken, and that was actually found to be unlawful by another court eventually, and he got those devices back, but he wasn't even charged with anything. And we don't know, because we don't know what conversations are happening within the corridors of power, but whether that was directed by Israel. But it's highly likely that they were involved, because he's a thorn in their side. And why would they take such extreme measures against the journalist that it had never happened before, who was covering the genocide? I don't think that it's preposterous or a conspiracy theory to say that they would be involved. It also happened to Richard Medhurst, another independent journalist. He was arrested at Heathrow and kept in solitary confinement for nearly 24 hours. Sarah Wilkinson, another journalist. All stuff that has not happened before. And this is misuse of terror laws. And that brings us up to Palestine Action, which is, again, unprecedented, because these are activists who are trying to stop the genocide, non-violent activists. They only destroy the machinery of genocide and weapons. And they were prescribed under the Terrorism Act of 2000. That had never happened before with the Direct Action Group. And that, more clearly, you can link to the Israel lobby, because people like Lord Wolney, who's John Woodcock, has been pushing for that for years, and he's associated with the Israeli lobby. He's also associated with the Saudi regime as well, and arms companies. And they were pushing that hard. And it's not a surprise. If you're an Israel lobbyist in this country, in the UK, you want the government to take out people who are raising the alarm, either through journalism or throwing their bodies on the gears of the genocidal machine if they're activists. And they've successfully done it. They've done it to the point that it's become an embarrassment. You know, the prescription of Palestine Action has been challenged hugely by popular movements. And 1,000 people nearly the other day were arrested under terrorism laws. A lot of them grannies and grandpas and vicars and disabled people, just normal people who are getting charged under terrorism laws for supporting a group which is trying to stop the genocide. And I would say, yes, it's very, very clear that the Israel lobby plays a role in that. Also, the arms industry as well, because although Palestine Action have just mainly targeted Elbit, which is Israel's largest weapons company, obviously, if you have activists trespassing and destroying weaponry on those sites, it's not good for the whole arms industry, which is why I think what they have done is has civilized British society, because it's made it harder for these weapons companies to base themselves here. But yeah, it's clear that the Israel lobby plays a role. I have to say as well that the Israel lobby and Israel itself see what's happened in Britain particularly as a defeat over the last 2 years, because you've had often the biggest demonstrations in the world on the streets of London. You've had Palestine Action. You've had all these different groups really changing the opinion of the population at large on Israel. That it's at its lowest point that it's ever been, Israel, in terms of its favorability ratings. So in a situation where you have the state and its media pumping out the propaganda, pumping out the genocide propaganda, and no one, the population at large, not buying it anymore, the only thing you can do is then revert to the law. And this goes back as well. It's not just Palestine Action. You know, the prescription of Hezbollah in 2019, that was explicitly at the behest of the Israel lobby. Lord Polak, who is maybe the main Israel lobbyist in the UK, he did an interview where he said they were talking about trying to prescribe the Israel lobby's next goal, or has been for a while, is to prescribe the IRGC, the Iranian Revolutionary Guards. And he was asked about this. He said, what we need to do is pure lobbying. It took us a while with Hezbollah, but it eventually worked. So that he was admitting that they lobbied hard to get Hezbollah prescribed, because it's not in Britain's interest in terms of, because prescription basically means you can't negotiate, you can't talk to. You lock off a channel of communication, and as a country that has a foreign policy and wants to keep its channels open, you don't want to prescribe all these different groups that have power. Like Hezbollah has ministers in the Lebanese government, and in 2019 they prescribed the political wing of Hezbollah as a terrorist organization, so it completely locks that channel off. So I think that decisions are being made in the UK Foreign Office, within the UK state, at the behest of the Israel lobby that are to the detriment of British national interests.
Right.
And that's because the level of power is so high.
Yeah, it's interesting that you mentioned Hezbollah, because Theresa May's government took that decision, as you said, to prescribe it as a terrorist group. And the reason that it gave, and quote, it's because they no longer saw it tenable to distinguish between the military and the political wings of Hezbollah. This is basically the narrative that the Israeli regime wants out there in order to make sure that the whole definition of resistance is not something that the general public can understand. And they try very hard, I think, if I'm correct to look at it that way, to push that aside and to form what they want to be out there, which is, again, no longer tenable to distinguish between military and political wings of Hezbollah. Is that a correct way of looking at it?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think that what's not commonly understood is that I think the main reason for the prescriptions of Hezbollah, Hamas, Palestine Action, all these groups, because Hamas and Hezbollah have never targeted the UK, it's the primary goal is not to criminalize membership, which is one part of that act. I think the primary goal is to stop people being able to speak openly about these groups who are resisting Israeli colonialism and Israeli genocide, because there's two parts to that, the Terrorism Act. If you prescribe an organization, yes, it's illegal to be a member, but it's also illegal to voice support. So, and that's why I think they do it. They want to clamp down on the ability on free speech, on the ability of people to speak openly about the conflict. I'm not saying you have to support these groups or everyone supports these groups, but the ability to have an open conversation about the rights and wrongs of resistance, about the situation within Lebanon, within Gaza, within Israel. You can't have it in the UK now. People are being arrested all the time for just speaking and having political conversations. I mean, an example I use sometimes is during the Vietnam War in the 60s and 70s in the United States, the Viet Cong, many, many people supported the Viet Cong who were resisting the American invasion. That was in America. The idea that it would become illegal to support the Viet Cong is unthinkable, or would have been unthinkable there. But here, you cannot talk openly at all about this stuff. And I think that's the purpose of it. That's the purpose of it, because they know they're losing control of the narrative. They're losing control of the population, and they don't want people to be able to speak openly about it, because once you clear away all the Israeli propaganda, the situation looks very, very different to how it's presented in the media. I mean, I know, everyone knows that the way that Israel have got their genocide done, and often all the other crimes that they do, is they just say Hamas, 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 Hamas. Like, there's no other argument. So if people don't feel like they can push back against that argument in an open way, then it scores them a victory. And that's the situation we have in the UK here.
Well, September 16th, Independent International Commission of Inquiry published its report on the OPT, where it said for the first time that Israel has committed genocide. It seems like that has struck a chord, although I find it to be somewhat, I'm not too sure what word to use, that we're still talking about whether this is a genocide or not. But it's better late than never, in a sense. But after 2 years for this report to come out, I think that is part of the problem, whether this conversation is still looking at whether this is a genocide or not. Maybe you can comment on that, but what I find interesting is one of your posts that said even the BBC has a new UN report as its main story, and this is the part that I found interesting, that you said the walls are closing in, every genocider and every accomplice will be held to account. We have 2 years' worth of receipts.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I think that I think you said you couldn't think of the word, but I find it disgusting that it's taken 2 years for the UN to find this, and for certain politicians to finally come out and say it now, because it was clear within a week that it was genocide, because they were not targeting the military facilities, they weren't targeting Hamas, they were targeting the civilian population from the beginning. And it was so obvious, you know, by December 2023, so 2 months in, 10,000 kids were killed. That wasn't a mistake. They were targeting civilian infrastructure, and you see, and now it's even more obvious with the complete destruction of Gaza, the toppling of all the the towers in Gaza City, which has been happening recently. They're erasing the whole of Gaza, but the program has never changed. They decided after October 7th that Gaza was finished. They were going to enact their final solution. So it's if the media had covered it how they should have, if the institutions which were told oversee international law and the international system had done had come had had used the evidence and viewed the evidence dispassionately early on, then we might not be here. Because 2 years later, yes, it's good that the UN's finally found it. It's good that politicians like Bernie Sanders has finally said it's a genocide. It's good that the mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, has said it's a genocide. But where have they been for the past 2 years? And if this pressure had been born earlier, we might not be where we are. It might be that Israel would have had to stop earlier. Because the other thing is, Israel's a small country with a small population, a relatively small GDP, and it couldn't survive without the support of the Western nations, particularly the United States, but also Britain and Iran. So, I'm sorry, not Iran, Britain and Germany. So if the political climate and the pressure had been borne on our political classes to stop the support, which has been intensive and direct, then Israel might have had to stop. Now they're talking about sanctions, but why weren't they sanctioning straight away? Why aren't they sanctioning when thousands of kids have been killed and targeted? So I find it pretty disgusting. The other point of it also is people are trying to now save face because it's so obvious what's going on that they know that how history will view this now, and they know how history will view their silence for 2 years. So now they're trying to say, well, it's a genocide and this is awful. But we know what has happened for the past 2 years. We know all the people that sure. were either giving support or being silent, and we will not go away. We will remind them of that till their dying day, because this is one of the worst crimes in history, and the people that supported it and the people that stayed silent allowed it to happen. Indeed. So, Yeah.
When you say they're trying to save face, you know, it sounds like this genocide is winding down in a sense, but which I hope to God it is. You know, many people obviously around the world are just sick and tired of seeing these, and they're really shocked. And keep getting more shocked. But we may be looking at a point in time in history where not only has this genocide not subsided yet, we're looking at many other genocides, and I would hate to see that happening, but we're seeing the sparks of it happening already in this region initiated by Israel. Look at what happened in Lebanon. Thousands killed there. The Islamic Republic of Iran. We had over 1,000 people who died, many of them, a large majority, women, children, just same scenario, of which this falls under that umbrella that Israel must expand itself. So something yeah. needs to be done now. You have the fact that there's an obligation where every country that's put on notice by the ICJ was a plausible risk of genocide in Gaza. Every country is obligated under international law not to just speak words, to take action. That means the Genocide Convention says that other countries have to therefore step in. So other countries need to step in. Do you think that we've reached that point now that we're seeing this genocide to have happened in Gaza?
Yeah, I do. And I think that we need military intervention, if possible, organized by the UN. Because as you say, the conventions that were signed after the Second World War and after the Holocaust stipulate that nations should take action when a genocide is underway. Ironically, of course, it's not the Western nations obviously should intervene to stop it. But what, as a first step, what they should do is stop supporting it and stop directly supporting it through military and intelligence help. You know, the US is providing huge amounts of arms. In fact, nearly all the arms, and the Germans as well. That should stop. The British are providing huge amounts of intelligence for them to get their operation done. That should stop. So that should be the first port of call. But yeah, eventually it should. Because as you say, we're in a new world now. Everything has been exposed. The mask is off. Israeli power, but particularly Western power as well. Because as I said, Israel is effectively a colony of the West in the Middle East. And I don't think there's any way back. There's no way back. There's a new world. Either we create a new system which actually works and actually does what it says, or we're in the law of the jungle, because Israel, it has no red lines, has no obstacles to any action they want to do. It's not just the attack on Lebanon, which was horrific, as you said, Iran as well. They bombed Qatar the other day, and that's a country that is effectively an outpost of the U.S. empire in the Middle East. They got the biggest U.S. base in the Middle East at Al Udeid. Over 10,000 American troops are there, and they just bombed it openly and apparently with the knowledge of Trump. So I think that there'll, more red lines will be crossed. They don't care. In fact, I actually think they flaunt it because they want people to be scared. Yeah, I said it's a gangster mentality where the Israelis want to project the image that they are completely all-powerful and no one can raise a finger of dissent or resistance against them. Otherwise, they'll be wiped out, and not just them wiped out, but everyone they know wiped out, their families, their friends. It's very similar, and I don't just say this for rhetorical purposes, but it does remind me very, very explicitly of the Nazis. The Nazis had the same mentality. They used to, if there was any resistance to the Nazi army, they would destroy whole towns and whole villages. It was a maximalist ideology, much like Zionism. And Netanyahu and his administration, they see October 7th as the event that they can use to justify any action. And that they think we're never going to get this chance again, so we want the final solution to the Palestinian problem, but also the Middle East problem, which is that there is resistance to this settler colony. So they are going all out, and the level of depravity and terrorism is unprecedented as well. If you look at another country which we haven't even mentioned, which they've been mercilessly bombing, is Yemen. Last week they bombed a Yemeni media facility, and they killed 31 journalists in one go, which might be the biggest single massacre of journalists in history. I don't know. I haven't looked into it, but that barely even made the papers in the UK. So this is
you can talk about how they killed almost the entire government setup and personnel.
Exactly.
You know,
yes,
these are targeted assassinations. You know, and when you talk about the level that the Zionist entity or Israeli regime can go and execute some of its plans in order to make sure that people are intimidated and scared of it, today is the 1-year anniversary of those pagers that went off in Lebanon. I mean, look at what they did there. That included cell phones as well. I mean, that's the extent that they go to. We can talk about that, but given the time restraint that we have, you mentioned about how we should, we've reached that point in history, we're in agreement there, and something needs to be done, and you talked about the UK, for example, providing intelligence. I found that this banner on your account to be very interesting, where on September 28th, I guess, there's going to be protest, and the part that was interesting was the header, where you said spy planes from Nevada, paid for by British dollars, launched from RAF Akrotiri in Cyprus, which provides intel for Israel to bomb Gaza. Which again, the question is, aiding an entity committing a genocide, doesn't that make that person guilty of genocide as well? But my question is, tell us more about that involvement of the UK when it comes to intel, and when it comes to even having boots on the ground, perhaps in the Gaza Strip, which there were some stories on that.
Yeah. So on the intel side, Britain has been a major player on providing intelligence from Gaza to the Israelis. Now, this was a story I've been covering for nearly 2 years now, but to summarize, basically in December 2023, the UK government announced it was going to put spy planes over the sky in Gaza in support of Israel. They didn't say where they were going from or how long they were in the air or what plane it was going to be, but I tracked it down to RAF Akrotiri and saw that they were going nearly daily, and still do, by the way. And they were in the sky for 5 hours. You could see the takeoffs and landings on flight tracking websites, but they turned their transponder off over the sea, so you could never see what they were doing over Gaza. But on July 28th, the pilot forgot to turn off his transponder for the first time. And we saw that it was circling Khan Yunis for nearly 2 hours. Now, the UK government had always said this is to do with hostage rescue, nothing else, nothing to do with the military campaign. But that we understood when we saw that footage or that video of the spy plane over Khan Yunis, why they turned their transponder off. Because all the fighting was happening in Khan Yunis. The Israeli government itself doesn't even think the hostages are in Khan Yunis. They think they're in either in the center or the north of Gaza. So why were we over Khan Yunis where all the main fighting was happening? The mainstream media had never covered this story beforehand, but subsequent to us finding that video and publishing a story about it, they got interested. And the other interesting thing about that was I looked at what plane, who that plane belonged to, and it wasn't the Royal Air Force, the British Air Force, which had been running these flights for 18 months. It was an American company. And we saw that it had gone from RAF Akrotiri. And that was extremely interesting. And at that point, we didn't know whether it had been contracted by the British, the Americans, the Israelis, or even a private entity like the Gaza Humanitarian Foundation. But the media got interested after that video came out, and a Times journalist through MOD, so Ministry of Defence sources, found that, yes, the UK military had contracted out a US corporation to run these flights. And that plane is still at RAF Akrotiri and still going over Gaza, we think. We don't know because it's completely turned off its transponder now, so we don't even know when it's taking off and landing, but we know it's still there. And this is direct participation in genocide. It's not anything else. It's not to do with hostage rescue. It's not to do with anything in line with international law. This is direct participation in genocide, and that's why they tried to keep it secret and always kept the flight path secret. The other interesting thing that came out subsequent to that video being released was this Times journalist also got the Ministry of Defence source to say that this information that the British are collecting and have been collecting over Gaza was going to the Israeli military. And not only that, going to the Israeli military in real time, so while the plane is in the sky. Now, up till that point, when the government had been asked, they'd always said, we only pass it to relevant authorities. They'd never said what those relevant authorities were. We could guess that it was the Israeli military as they were running the operation, but we never could say for a fact. But now we know that it's been going to the Israeli military. We know that it's been going in real time. So this is direct participation in genocide. Britain is leading in providing intelligence to the Israelis. Al Jazeera did an investigation that found nearly half of all surveillance flights over Gaza during a genocide had been done by the British. More than double Israel itself. Sure. That's the Al Jazeera finding. So it's a insane scenario. And now the British taxpayer is paying an American corporation to run these spy flights for the Israelis. And we're not even allowed to know how much that contract costs us. So we're paying to participate in genocide, and we're not even allowed to know how much.
Thank you so much. Unfortunately, we're out of time, but it was a pleasure talking to you. Thank you for your input, Matthew Kennard, author and independent investigative journalist. Thanks.
Thanks a lot. Bye.
Bye-bye. Well, that does it for this edition of Unscripted. You heard the words of Matthew Kennard, obviously painting what seems to be a very not positive future ahead for the West Asia region in particular, and of course the Palestinians themselves. From Mikavi Tapai and the entire team here at Unscripted, it's goodbye. Whatever I will be, I don't need to be what you need me to be. Yeah. I thank God for what He's done for me. You give me so much light, and you make me feel invincible. Alhamdulillah, yeah.
Alhamdulillah. Yeah, 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 yeah. Alhamdulillah. Ooh. Allah's love has no limits. Allah's love has no boundaries. For every raindrop that falls, for every ray of sunshine, for everything is under His control. You cannot see Allah, you cannot touch Allah, but you can feel Allah. He is there in every tear that falls, in every smile that shows. Allah is all around us. I am whatever I may be, but Allah has already planned my destiny.
Good night to all of our listeners. You are tuned into Iran Radio, broadcasting from Tehran. I'm your presenter for the next hour. Stay with us. Straightly, we go to the interesting facts about Islam. During the Golden Age of Islam, Muslims created a house of wisdom, or Baitul Hikmah, which was active during the 9th and 13th century, where both Muslims and non-Muslims scholars sought to translate the world's knowledge into Arabic. Many classic works of antiquity that might have otherwise been lost were preserved in Arabic and Persian and later translated into Turkish, Hebrew, and Latin. Here, scholars synthesized and significantly advanced knowledge gained from the Persian, Roman, Chinese, Egyptian, Greek, Byzantine and Phoenician civilizations. Muslim scholars like Ibn Rushd and Avicenna were primarily responsible for saving the works of prominent Greek philosopher Aristotle. We start off this hour's lineup with dialogue. The program looks at the most important conversations between Shiite imams and their followers, questioners, and leaders of other Islamic faith and sects. They will be followed by Islamic upbringing. The program aims to answer frequently asked questions regarding children and adolescents and their upbringing. Then it's time for our varied radio productions feature. And our final program this hour is Leader's Speech. The program presents an English translation of a selection of the statements and speeches of the Honorable Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei. Stay with us for the next hour.
We have to have a very fair assessment of this academic and intellectual icon of early Islam.
His impact is more pronounced in jurisprudence that he formalized.
And tens of thousands of statements and teachings have reached us from Al-Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam.
This is Dialogue, an introduction to the most important dialogues and conversations of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue and I'm your host Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the history of Islam, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. The sixth divinely appointed Imam, Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salam, was an incredibly prominent character in the history of the Muslims. He benefited humankind with his highly scientific achievements, many of which had never been seen before by humanity. Imam Ja'far as-Sadiq alayhi salam's instructions in the acts of worship and transactions and his contribution in the field of legislation were amazing achievements that had not occurred before amongst the Muslim masses. and His Eminence also had a positive and active share in the establishment of human culture and civilization. The sixth divinely appointed Imam, the son of Imam Baqir alayhi salam, an individual who was divinely appointed by the Almighty Allah, was known to have improved the general public lives of the people and the Muslims, and he was an individual, a divinely appointed Imam, a man from the household of the Holy Prophet, who enhanced human thoughts and discovered many of the secrets of this universe. Welcome back, dear listeners. This is IRIB English Radio, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam. So, dear friends, we are humbly at your service speaking about the dialogues and the conversations of the sixth divinely appointed Imam, Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam. So, there is an interesting conversation that happens between two individuals, and it is regarding His Eminence, the sixth divinely appointed Imam. So we find that one of the great poets of the era, by the name of Abdullah ibn al-Mubarak, somebody came and asked him about Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. And so this great poet, Abdullah ibn al-Mubarak, he says that I am completely amazed by the great position and status of Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. He said that he has such an admiring personality that it is truly difficult to express Imam al-Sadiq as he deserves, because all words of praise can never describe him, how he is, and how he deserves to be described. It's really interesting that some of the poems that were written and composed by Abdullah ibn al-Mubarak are very beautiful poems where he conveys the beliefs of the Shias about the holy Imams and how they are the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, and they are the representatives of the Messenger of Allah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, and even the fact how they are the true leaders of the Muslim Ummah. And so it's really beautiful, you know, to see these beautiful words of individuals regarding Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam. You know, again, there is little information that we have, or at least we don't have knowledge about all of the information that is out there regarding the divinely appointed, immaculate, and infallible Imams, alayhim as-salam. You know, we find that we have limited certain Imams to very small instances of their lives. And, you know, really that seems to be a disservice to these Imams. So Imam Sajjad alayhi salam is only known for his du'as, or Imam Hussein alayhi salam is only known for the event of Ashura in the land of Karbala. Imam Hassan alayhi salam is only known for the ceasefire peace treaty that occurred. And likely, you know, we find that Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, he is mostly known for his scientific aspects, his scientific expertise, his expertise in other sciences. So, you know, he's given a very academic type of visage and a very, you know, form of being an academic. When in reality, you know, we find that their personas, their personalities, their behaviors, all of these were incredibly magnificent. And they should definitely be spoken about more often. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam. IRIB English Radio. Our radio programs and podcasts on iranradio.ir. We'll be right back.
And now let's listen to Sayyid Muhammad Jawad Al-Ghazwini.
Another beautiful teaching from Al-Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam is the following hadith. Implementing this hadith gives you peace of mind, my dear brothers and sisters. It brings you rahat al-qalb. It removes stress from your life. The Imam alayhi salam states, "Ar-raghbatu fi dunya turithu al-ghamma wal-huzn." والزهد في الدنيا راحة القلب والبدن. The Imam says, having expectations from this worldly dunya, from materialism, always pursuing this dunya, wanting this dunya, wanting money, wanting power, wanting this position, wanting attention, competition for attention. The Imam says this leads to sadness, to depression, to grief, because you can never get enough of this dunya. You reach this stage, you want more. You want more attention, you want more likes, you want more comments, you want more money, right? It doesn't stop. You buy 10,000 crypto, the market crashes, you keep buying more and more and more. It doesn't stop. We have that greed. This greed will generate depression in your heart. It will generate sadness in your heart. But the Imam says the zuhd fi dunya, being indifferent to this world, cutting and severing unhealthy attachments with this world, this brings you rahat al-qalbi wal-badan, peace of mind, and it brings you a good body, a healthy body, because stress kills. One of the biggest reasons why people have heart attacks is stress. Stress kills a lot of people. Just like other things like smoking and cancer kills a lot of people. Stress is a big killer here in this country.
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of the program, Dialogue. For more information, visit our website at iranradio.ir. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us. And try to apply them to our daily lives. How is it possible? By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي ارسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones. But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن.
Muslims' major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran, Quran.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum. A very warm welcome. You're listening to IRIB English Radio, and this is Islamic Upbringing. This is your host, Zainab. And I'm glad to be your host. Well, in this program, we discuss the topics that are important for parents, for teenagers, for the Islamic upbringing. So we discuss very sensitive topics and very challenging topics, rather. The answers of our guest experts are based on the Holy Book of Quran and the Ahadith from our noble prophet. May Allah's peace and blessings be upon him and his purified progeny. And also, we discuss narrations from noble imams to support our answers. Well, our guest expert today is Brother Muhammad Liaqat Abbas. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum salam, sister.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you so much.
Well, Brother Liaqat Abbas is a research scholar in the Hawza Ilmi of Qum, who also holds a background in psychology, which makes him a perfect guest for our program. Well, in today's episode, we are going to discuss something very amazing: the beauty of waiting. Yes, with us again, there's Brother Liaqat Abbas. Assalamu alaikum.
Alaikum salam, sister.
A very warm welcome.
Thank you so much.
Dear listeners, Brother Liaqat Abbas is a renowned scholar in the Hawza Ilmi of Qum, and he also has a background in psychology, which makes him a perfect guest for our program. So today, brother, I want to ask you that in a world of instant likes, fast deliveries, and one-click satisfaction, how do we as parents teach our children the beauty of waiting, the faith that the real reward is not in life's notifications, but in the hereafter's recognition?
Okay. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So in today's world, this is quite difficult because of the algorithm which is going on in the internet, in AIs, in the short videos.
Yeah.
So instant gratification. Indeed. Or instant rewards are normal in today's world.
Yes.
So a person is never bored, and a person is always busy.
Everything
even
is
a kid
one
is
click
busy.
Away.
Mm-hmm. Indeed. Yeah. So once a person feels bored, he's going to open Insta or whatever, like YouTube or stuff like that, and he's going to get himself busy into it.
Yeah.
So over here, because we have got used to getting this instant
things
rewards.
Instant, yeah.
Now the concept of amal, and that is the actions,
mm-hmm.
with the delayed rewards, that
yeah.
is in the hereafter.
Yeah.
And when we speak about rewards, it's to be frank, it's from the time of death, you
mm-hmm.
see, because there are many narrations that
yeah.
it's because of the actions of the mu'min
yeah.
that the Ahlul Bayt alayhim as-salam are going to come to him. They're
yeah.
going to visit the like ready to die person, mm-hmm. where the soul of the person is getting detached from his body, the 14 infallibles are going to come to visit him or her.
Mm-hmm.
And it will be asked to that person who yeah. is going to die. It will be asked to him or her if he wants to live more in mm-hmm. this world. Then the person will look towards one side of his and he will see his family members. He'll see the other side and he will see the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam.
Right.
And he would say, okay, now I don't want to stay in this world any longer. Why? Because I see my family members joining me very soon.
Right.
And I want to go towards the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. That is when it will be ordered that the soul of the person to be removed, or the soul of the person should be detached from his body.
Yeah.
So it's basically the reward system starts from the very death mm-hmm. and like inside the grave, and the realm of Barzakh is like a big chunk of rewards waiting for a person over there. And in hereafter, it will be a beautiful hereafter. It will be an easy hereafter for that person. That is the moment I'm talking about.
Yeah.
And then the everlasting reward, that is paradise.
Right.
So when we say this concept to a child, when we say this concept even to ourselves, like to elders, example,
right?
It's a bit like, okay, I'm going to recite this namaz right now and I'm going to get the reward someday, you see, mm-hmm. like a day which we have never seen.
Right.
Okay? So it becomes kind of hard for us to explain the next generation, especially
yeah.
about the delayed rewards.
Right.
So over here, this is a style we have to adopt now in order to make them understand that, look, don't see this as delayed rewards. When you say about delayed rewards, the child will say, okay, it's not existing.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Instead, if we say it's like an investment,
mm-hmm.
if you consider it as an act of investment, then the child might
Which
understand.
It's going to have mm-hmm. its benefits, even if it's going to be delayed.
Yeah.
But it's going to be... like that. So yeah, we'll discuss more with you after a short break, dear listeners. Don't go anywhere. Stay tuned.
Give thanks to Allah for the moon and the stars. Praise Him all day for what is and what was. Take hold of your iman. Don't give in to shaitan. Oh, you who believe, please give thanks to Allah. Allahu Ghafoor. Allahu Rahim, Allahu Yuhibbul Muhsinin, wa Khaliquna, wa Rasiquna, wa Huwa ala kulli shay'in qadir.
Welcome back. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. Brother Muhammad Liaqat Abbas is with us, and we are discussing the beauty of waiting. Well, I want to say, while you were discussing this concept, it reminded me of one of the sufferings back then when I was hardly 12 or 13 years old. And we had a huge, huge, huge earthquake in Kashmir. And all the buildings were turned into rubble. And there was no electricity, there was nothing, and we were in camps, and even in those set up camps, there was one thing that we are all together. This is a communal suffering. Like maybe we don't have homes right now, we don't have roof overhead, and this is without light thing, there's tithing, there's this and that, yes. But that was still, there was one kind of satisfaction that everyone was checking on one or the other person.
Mm-hmm.
This suffering is always better than when I visit the graveyards and I realize this is not the same camp wherein there was no light and the buildings were turned into rubble. We were still breathing and we were all together. We were along with each other. But here, this person is all alone. And it's way more better that this person gets rewards here and hereafter rather,
yeah.
Than getting those rewards in the world. Because even in the worst Indeed. Case scenarios mm-hmm. in the world, mm-hmm. there is some community with you. And maybe you don't need those rewards very instantly.
So this is a methodology, just like you have said, this is a way to convey it to the child, like taking to the graves will make him or her understand about the hereafter, that one or the other day, that very child will also enter the grave, have to enter the grave.
Has to.
So I'm going to enter the grave, you are going to enter the grave.
Right.
So it's a reality, like basically.
Every soul will have to taste the death.
So another thing is, like, instead of telling them, okay, this is a delayed reward for the child, as I said, it is not real. Delayed reward is not real. This is what they are going to consider because of the present era.
Right.
The psychological wiring is in such a manner that they want immediate response, immediate
rewards.
Right now,
right here.
Exactly, yeah.
Right.
So what example we can give to them over here is like a seed. If we are going to plant a seed right now, you're not going to see the tree right now itself.
Instantly.
So instead of telling them the rewards are going to be given one day, making them realize, okay, like giving them examples in such a manner that they can feel it. Even in this world, the rewards are not instant.
Yeah.
You have to work hard. Example, you are going to tell your child, example, if you go to the school, you're not going to get job right away.
Right.
You have to wait for a few
years.
Some
things are gradual.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So with the process, it happens with the process.
Right.
So in this manner, the namaz which you're reciting today is not a namaz which you're going to get the reward or you're going to pay for it straight away.
Right away.
It's a thing like a tree. You have to wait for it.
Right. Interesting discussion. We'll continue it after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned.
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, "Raise your children to have three features: love for your Prophet, love for his household, and reciting the Quran."
Welcome back. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. This is Islamic Upbringing. Brother Muhammad Liaquat Abbas is here with me. And we are discussing the beauty of waiting. We said that things do not come instantly in this instant world, even if our children are used to instant likes, instant feedback, instant deliveries, everything instantly, everything one click away from them. But there are things which has rather made it challenging for our parents, their parents and all the mentors, that to teach them the gradual process of waiting and the reward of there are many things that do not come overnight, but they do come by time.
Yes.
So, yes.
So I was telling about the seed which